and you're just, you're relentlessly just throwing new creative that kind of inherits some of the winning stuff, tries to move away from the losing stuff. And in that way, you can kind of step change, you know, over time. You can improve your performance over time because you're kind of like gravitating towards what works for an audience, what kind of language, what kind of stories, that kind of thing.
This is the Baby Bathwater Podcast, an exceptionally unscripted and underproduced adventure within entrepreneurial reality. Hosted by Hollis Carter and Michael Lovitch, co-founders of the Baby Bathwater Institute and the most reluctant podcasters this side of the Mississippi.
So today is going to be a fun day. We got a lot of people on this panel, and we're talking about artificial intelligence and your business, primarily on marketing and things digital, like customer service or marketing or acquisition, those kind of things, and how AI can integrate. And it's a big discussion in our group. And we didn't really have experts in our group, so we had to go outside of our group. And so really a big thank you to Will Hanschel and James Chadwick from Pencil.io. And they're actually somehow making AI work for media buying and Facebook. So we have these two. We also have Mike Binyard, who's a member of our group, who has an agency, Rainmaker, and he's been testing a lot of these tools as well. So I want to get his perspective. And then we have Todd Zhang, who runs Falcon Fulfillment, a really successful fulfillment center. And he's been trying to make AI work for customer service. And this is a chance for him to go through these issues about how it's not quite working and maybe what we can do to have that happen. And then the co-host today is Satya Gupta, Conscious Creators. He's the one who actually connected us with James and Will. And we're going to co-host this thing. So welcome, everybody.
Hey.
Thanks, Mike. Right.
Hey, Michael.
Great to be here.
All right. So I'll just open it up. There's something called OpenAI GPT-3, which I think is going to be foundational to this whole conversation. So what the hell is it? Whoever wants to take a bite.
The one you want me to take?
Yeah, this is whoever feels most comfortable.
It's GPT-3. It's like a big old language model. So think of it as an algorithm that's read like a large part of the English internet and picked up, you know, what humans have written, spotted patterns in it, and kind of internalize that. And then you can hit it with like what they call prompts, which are kind of like inputs, and it responds, which is called inference. And, you know, it responds based on what it has learned by connecting all these dots. So you can use it for lots of different tasks. So we use it at Pencil for generating ad copy, you know, that's creative, you know, that's about your product, but also relevant to your audience or whatever. But because it's a language model, you can use it for other interesting things as well, or you can ask it questions. You know, you can give it half a chapter of a Harry Potter book where the Star Wars characters are attending Hogwarts and it will finish the chapter. So it's a very, very cool piece of technology. And it's also a piece of technology that has reached a state where it is compelling and commercially viable. So we experimented with earlier models like GPT-2, which, you know, we're not. But GPT-3 is pretty magical in real life.
So it's basically a database of written words, but there's has to be syntax. Like, so it's intelligent in some way.
Yeah, it's not a database. Don't think of it as a database. It is the database is the internet with, you know, right, all of the word out there already. It is a model that has kind of internalized the relationships between the data, which is, you know, everything everyone has said online. And it is internalized in such a way that it can respond when prompted with unstructured text input. So there is intelligence in the sense that it has formed connections that it can use to respond to input, but it's not intelligence in the sense that it knows that it is responding or who you are or anything like that. So it's kind of like a non-human intelligence.
God, so it's kind of like me. It says things, but it doesn't know it is saying
things. You got it.
Just real quick, who owns this? So it's an open, it's open. It's like open source is like Linux kind of thing. Like it's just a community project, or does somebody own it and run it and improving it?
Yeah, OpenAI was an Elon Musk idea, right? It was about, you know, if AI is going to be super powerful, which he believes it is. And if you read blog posts like the ones on Wait But Why, which got me interested in AI, you know, you realize that AI has tremendous upside potential in terms of, you know, GPT-3 is awesome, but it's only 2021. Like, can you imagine what we're going to be doing in 2030? So Elon Musk started OpenAI to do pretty low level academic research into AI, to also make it useful, to provide useful applications, make it like demystify it, and to essentially operate as a think tank and research group in an open enough way that it could be less likely it was used for ill purposes. Wow. But it is a tech startup. It is very well funded. It's been invested in by Microsoft. And GPT-3 is provided as an API to partners like us, on a paid basis. So it's not a you know, an open source, you know, free it. Thing. They've started to monetize it, you know, to sustain themselves.
And is it the only game in town?
It is not the only game in town in terms of language models. Like, bigger models have been trained and that kind of thing, but it is the closest to, they wouldn't call it production ready, it's still in beta, but it is made available to people who are willing to pay a small fee for the API, and it is production ready in some use cases, and in ways that other language models are not.
Google's also working on a model that's supposed to be like 6 times more powerful than GPT-3. But as far as I know, GPT-3 is the only model that's available to the public and people are currently able to publicly build on.
That's cool. So when they have theirs, we'll have them like do a poetry slam contest or something against each other. And
yeah, that'll 100% be a thing.
Yeah, it will be a thing. Sachit, any follow-up?
Yeah, something I'm curious about is like the way you described it, I'm sure there's like sort of like a compounding effect in terms of like how it gets better, right? Like the more information it gets, the more it creates, and then like the more information it has and it keeps getting better. What is the bridge to it becoming as intelligent as sort of like humans? And what are the implications of that?
Yeah, it's kind of like an idiot savant is how some of the community talk about it, in the sense that it's superhuman in many ways. Like, it can instantly write 10 chapters of a new book that, you know, instantly. But it doesn't have any empathy. The chapters of the book could be interesting, right? They could be like, they're readable. Like but that doesn't mean, like, does that mean there's equal value to what a human wrote, or less value? Or does it matter whether it was written by a human or machine, as long as it's interesting? And I think it is humanness in lots, it's human in lots of visible ways, but it's not human. And I think that for some tasks that won't matter. You know, if it's writing like a chapter of a book, super interesting, cool. You know, but if it's doing something like customer service and it doesn't have empathy, maybe that is a problem in that use case. So, but who knows, right? I think a lot of this needs to be kind of tried and attempted and discovered as we go along.
Got it. So I know that you're using it, you know, for ads. What other applications right now is this OpenAI or any other source being used effectively besides ads? Like, are people using it for copy? Are people using it to write books?
Yeah, I mean, sorry, Todd, go ahead.
No, I was, I was just gonna jump in with a couple use cases. There's a couple tools that are out now where it's being used in like prospecting tools, where it can write out like full prospecting emails. There's kids using it to write their college papers. There's already some use cases where GPT-3 has beat like other humans at like writing competitions. And there's also a ton of like interesting things like what Will and James are doing, where it can take language and turn it directly into images and graphics, et cetera.
You say image, yeah, images. So now how does it work then? So this is like, let's go into pencil. This is, I think, a good use case too, is what do you have to do? So open API and open AI, right? So this is, this intelligence, whatever you want to call it, going on, language intelligence. Now, when people are using this, you have to write a front end for it, right? Or it's not its own front end, right? When you say like, hey, people writing papers. So how does that all work? So you have to do a front end interface to the source to make it do something, correct?
Correct. Yeah. If you want to turn it into a tool like we have, you got to build your own kind of product, right? Your own front end. you also have to prompt it. So you don't just hit it with a question out of the blue. But you can, but if you want to kind of control the way it responds, because it could say anything, right? You often prompt it. So they use a technique called few shot learning, where basically in the API call, you send an example of a question and an answer of the type you're looking for. So you send kind of question, answer, 3, 4, 5 times. And then you send a question without an answer. And it responds with an answer in the style of the examples you've given. So that's, in addition to kind of building a front end to allow you to interface with it, you need to kind of provide a little bit of control such that the users who are asking questions are getting a structured answer that you kind of like know the structure of. Otherwise, it will just, you know, it will respond whatever it thinks, which is not a, you know, a repeatable kind of consistent experience for a user in a commercial context. So it's the interface and the prompt that you have to create.
Got it. So when you're searching for solutions or companies with, you know, they say AI for X, the art is how you use this. So you have this tool, the open AI tool, the GPT-3, but the art is then how do you build a front end on that so it spits out useful information for whatever purpose you're using it for.
Exactly. And, you know, there's lots that you can build on it as well, right? On top of it, which we have. So, you know, you need to interface with it. You need to prompt it. You need to, you know, control usage of it so that people don't spam it. You need to control for diversity. So sometimes it will spit out same responses and you need to make sure that the user doesn't get that. Mm-hmm. OpenAI have done a lot of work on safety. So, you know, if things are misogynist, even, you know, very like subjective and kind of language-based, there's filters that you can apply. There's sentiment filters, you know, race, different political causes and issues. You want to control some of that. And, you know, learning, right? Like it is one giant model, one brain in a vat, and it's responding to every single one of its users based on these prompts. So if you want it to respond to your users in a certain way, like if with us, we want it to understand someone's brand, right? And kind of, you know, if they like certain words or not certain words in terms of how they talk about their business, they want GPT-3 to kind of do more of what they like over time and less of what they don't like. And because it's one model, we have to add all of that capability on top of its outputs. So you can build on top of it. It's a low level kind of like foundation for
platform.
So Will, from a marketing perspective, like it sounds like you're feeding it all of these inputs to then get to a point where it can actually be useful, right? So from a marketing perspective, what are the inputs that you fed it that it can actually now create really great copy?
Yeah, so it's, the first question is like, what is really great copy? Right. So, you know, and the answer is that it's different for every brand. So like some brands like to be serious, some like to be funny, you know, and some ads are top of funnel and are more about, you know, awareness driving, and some are bottom of funnel and needs to be like buy now, you know? So we've adopted, you know, frameworks and points of view on what good copy is for, you know, general businesses and marketers in D2C, which is our space. And we've prompted it with good examples of, you know, a description of a brand and product, you know, the features, the ingredients, you know, examples of, you know, what that product's all about. And then, you know, what the narrative of a video ad looks like for that brand or could look like for that brand. So, you know, grab attention, A, talk about the benefits of the product, B, and then drive towards consideration to purchase, C. So we have like our video ads are kind of generated with like a narrative, not just an individual line of copy that works well, but like a story that does that ABC job. Mm-hmm. And the copy that's generated by pencil as a result, because we're not just generating lines, we're trying to generate like a video ad, like a story. So, you know, it's about producing multiple lines of copy that work together as a narrative and that can be modularized and tested to see, you know, you grab attention in this way, but you land that benefit. Does that work better than, you know, the other way around and that kind of thing? So, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. You kind of like abstracted it into a framework and then we deliver that framework.
Right. So when you're looking at companies who claim to use OpenAI and GPT, it's really a matter of how well they trained it. So it's for somebody to say, yeah, we plugged into this amazing OpenAI, it's so smart, that's a ruse. So that's why you have like 50 companies with these claims. So it's a matter of how well that company has trained it for the result.
Yeah, this is James here. I think you've touched on a really interesting thing there, that training. I think in a sense, we got really lucky in the sense that we had this huge and very specific and kind of tangible problem that hundreds and thousands of marketers were facing. mm-hmm. we could apply OpenAI to. So, and that problem was, you know, Facebook and Instagram spend is $70 to $80 billion. There's 10 million advertisers. The biggest way, the easy, you know, the most important way to get performance is to have strong creative, is to turn up week on week with, you know, fresh new video creative. And actually just generating that amount, that volume and variety of different creative is really hard. When I was at Facebook, you know, my team was spending hundreds of millions of dollars of Facebook's money on Facebook ads. We had a huge team of creatives, and it was really hard to get just 5 or 10 creative ads a week from a team of humans. And so this was a really big problem that people are facing. And also the great thing about this problem is it has a immediate feedback loop of data coming back. So you can build these ads, you can then run them, and then within hours you're getting data back. And that's how Pencil works, right? You connect Pencil to Facebook. So we not only build these ads, but when people run them, the data comes back mm-hmm. into Pencil. And as you said, like trains the model. So what happens is we end up training the model for each individual brand, like tens of thousands of brands in the future. And so we're really trying to crack the code for each brand individually on Facebook. And that's just a great problem to be trying to solve.
Just, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
So since you guys have all that data for the kind of cohort of advertisers that you guys are working with, does all of that data train the model as a whole, or does it only work for each individual brand?
It's individual brand. So think of it. When we started out trying to apply AI to marketing, one of the things you don't want as an AI company is to be data starved, right? Like, and marketing, even though there are lots of ads in aggregate, you know, each individual advertiser maybe has dozens, hundreds of data points. Especially when you start controlling for a specific audience or a specific country, like it gets quite small. So we need to apply approaches on that that feedback loop that are accurate at small scale. Or value add, a net value add at small scale. So we found that the best way to do that is to do it the way that, you know, performance marketers already do it, which is, you know, you run 10 ads, 2 of them work well, 8 don't. So you learn, kind of, you look at the 8 that didn't work and you kind of like downweight the characteristics in those 8, and you look at the 2 that really worked and you kind of upweight those characteristics. And then the next batch of 10 are kind of similar to the 2 that worked, dissimilar to the 8 that didn't, but are still new in their own ways as well. And you're relentlessly just throwing new creative that kind of inherits some of the winning stuff and tries to move away from the losing stuff. And in that way, you can kind of step change, you know, over time. You can improve your performance over time because you're kind of like gravitating towards what works for an audience, what kind of language, what kind of stories, that kind of thing. And that can be done with a relatively small data. It's not a giant deep learning model trained on millions of data points, because no individual advertiser has that for their own context. So we took a different approach to make it work.
You're saying that you're not each client, your overall AI is not learning from all the clients and then applying it appropriately across, because you think you'd learn some generic things, right? Like that's what we all get together as direct response marketers, and we all share our shit and we all get better, right? So you have to be learning something that's some things that you can apply to the success of everybody, and I would assume.
Yeah, it's something that we want to do and kind of provide to users as soon as we see that it is valuable and the value outweighs any potential hesitation right. of pooling data together. So people are cool to kind of pool data if the value they get is sufficient, right? Like, you know, the models need to be much more accurate or much more insightful or really give them something that they didn't know about before. So that requires a certain scale, you know, a certain coverage of different industries and markets and, you know, and audiences. So it's something that we will do over time with buy-in of our users, obviously.
So on the back end, or like, you know, outside of the conflict, which I think totally makes sense, are you seeing like any interesting trends with the data that you guys have access to?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I think they're like, if you think about like creative characteristics, there's like low level stuff, which is, you can think of as like best practices, which you kind of should do and will kind of work for everyone. And then there are like very high level features, which are very small, you know, things like color changes and word use, which are very specific to your audience, your brand, et cetera. So the low level stuff is things, you know, that as good performance marketers, you know already, you know, like say what the product is, you know, say what the product is. Maybe show the product as early as possible in the ad, you know, you know, things that are known to work and that logically should work. Things that Facebook tells you to do because they know to work, you know, those tend to be the low level features. That the exciting stuff, and a lot of people don't do the best practice, by the way, so that is still valuable. But the exciting stuff, I think, comes with the data that's unique to you. And I think in a world in the future where AI powers everything, it's the value that it delivers just to you that gives you an edge for your business against your competitors. That would become interesting as well, right? So we work with a pet food brand that discovered that talking about taste works better than talking about nutrition for their audience. Now, a buyer of pet food would not be expected to care about the taste, right? They're not the one eating the dog food. The dog's eating it. So why does taste work so well? Because pet owners, obviously, care the dog,
their animals. Dog
experience, right? So it's like those unintuitive, like non-obvious insights are what we are so excited about, because if they can discover that before their others and they can apply that and they can become the brand that talks about that, then that's a sustainable advantage for them. So that's what we're trying to provide to our users.
How much training then? So I'm a brand using your software. When can I just say, fuck it, AI is doing it all for me? Like, how much work do I got to do? And I know it's like time's not the right thing, in volume, not time, because time's relative to how many ads you're buying, blah, blah, blah. When can I like relax and let the AI take over? How much do I got to do that?
I have a great story on this from last week. So we had a new brand sign up, great brand. I'll actually name them, but they're a military, what is it? A military tested personal care brand called Bravo Sierra. And they signed up, and the VP of marketing, she's awesome, Kate, she jumped on and she said, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to open this up to the whole team, right? We're going to let everyone play around with this thing, right? Because we allow unlimited users. We don't charge by the seat. So the whole team dived in and she said, I'm going to turn it into a competition, right? So everyone go and create the ads. We'll throw them into Facebook and we'll see who's the winner, which is a very brave thing to do as a marketer, but it's great. That's exactly what you should do. And the winning ad, the highest performing ad, was done by the person in the team who had the least experience with performance marketing. She was, I think, the influence marketer. And she made the fewest changes of all, right? Because you can build the ads and then you can edit them as well. And she made the fewest edits. And so their takeout from that was like, okay, well, that gives us the evidence that actually we can take our hands off a little bit here and trust the AI, because it was the person who trusted the AI the most that got the highest results.
Right, but then going forward, can they just let the AI do everything? Like, how long does it take to allow the AI to do stuff so you can just go about and like play golf, things like that?
so you definitely need to have a human in control, right? Because the AI could write something or say something that you don't want to say about your brand. So you need a human in control to review things before they finally go out. But as long as you're getting the assets, you're getting some good photography and you're getting some good video and you're putting in, you know, just testing a few little value propositions, you can then hit the button, generate, let's say, 30 ads, look at them, pick 5 or 10 that you want to go with. We give a prediction of which ones we think the machine thinks that are perform the best. So you can go along with the machine's prediction and then you can go and play golf.
Yes, Mike.
Is there an inflection point that you guys see in the future where that's not the case? I know from using like Copysmith and some of the other tools that you do need to look at the copy. You have to have somebody there to filter it. But do you guys see a point in the not so certain future that there will be more golf and less babysitting the robots?
Yeah, I think the underlying technology will get better, and the learning loops that kind of learn what you like will get better. So, you know, as a brand, if you do like in your space, you do like certain words, don't like certain words or themes, you know, that will become internalized, if not in the underlying language model, then in like the systems that sit on top of it, like ours. So I think it will get better, but you know, 99% is still 99%. 1% of the time it says something that you don't want, you know. My personal view is that AI will be able to pretty much do anything, but it can't be accountable, right? Like if it's your business, your small business, and something is said that offends someone in an ad because you didn't oversee it, you can't blame GPT-3, right? It's like you, the business owner, takes ultimate responsibility. So you're going to want to, you know, wake up in the morning, see 5 ads that AI have suggested and be like, yes, 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 no. Like, I think it will get to that point. You could run it. And I think a lot of people want to just let it run, but you have to accept then that you'll be responsible if, you know, forgetting all the legality, right? It's your business. It said something. You will be responsible, be held responsible. So I think it's in our users' interest, in our interest, in everyone's interest to have a level of oversight, unless you're willing to accept, you know, unlimited risk. Mm-hmm.
You drive a Tesla, it's a little bit like autopilot. I mean, you could go to sleep, but it's not advisable.
So what we need is the AR glasses, and then those like pop-ups can pop up on the glasses while we're playing golf, saying approve these ads, and then, you know, we can go to town.
That could work.
So this AI is a language AI, and then you're using it for video too, which is kind of cool. But then what's the difference between this AI and like the Google AI that beat like StarCraft 2, which is crazy town, like the most complicated video game in the world, Google's winning it, the AI, or the Deep Blue and all that. It seems like this is different, a different kind of AI, or am I confused?
No, it's similar in terms of like, they're both deep learning approaches, right? GPT-3 is a transformer based like model framework. You can think of it, type of model that's been trained on a certain data set. And then, you know, the systems that have played Go and chess and StarCraft are other deep learning kind of model architectures that have been trained on a different data set, in those cases gameplay, or have even been set up to kind of learn the game's rules from scratch by playing against themselves. So yeah, you can think about AI development as like, what is the model being used? How does it learn? How does it assimilate? Yeah. You know, and then what is the data set? But I think that there's a general trend towards certain structures, certain types of models, you know, certain approaches that are more general, which is, again, the idea behind GPT-3. Language is so fundamental that even though it's been trained on words, it can do math, right? It can translate. Right. And maybe learn to play games because the rules of a game are written down, you know, if you know what I mean? So they took a view that built a language model, it would have the most general value because language is so universal.
Right, because marketing's a game, right? So you have like the GPT-3, right, which is more of a language AI model. And then I'm just curious if they were going to try gaming models because it is a game, right? And the rules, and there's somebody to beat. So I was just curious about that combination, or whether anybody else is, for marketing or business purposes, is using that kind of AI.
For gaming?
For gaming, yeah, competitive. You know, like, I'm going to win.
So I guess my mind jumped to, like, video games. So maybe this is not exactly what you're saying, but there's already some companies applying GPT-3 to being able to create language dynamically for characters in like role-playing games, for example. Mm-hmm. Because it could spit out novel responses. Right now, you basically, like, the writers have to go in for a game and write all this different like set prompts. And, you know, it can feel novel, but somebody had to go in and write all that stuff. With GPT-3, you can get brand new responses that you're not even expecting. And there's already a couple of demos out there where they have that connected to like a visual reference for the character, or like an avatar. So it won't be long until that gets applied to, I think, like the AI for like actual video games.
I actually think I think the gaming aspect of marketing is a really good analogy, and I think it's actually a really good way of thinking about marketing now, especially this kind of performance marketing, mm-hmm. because the conversations that I'm having day in, day out with, you know, D2C founders and performance marketers and growth agencies, we're really talking about, well, when we talk about Facebook, how do you win on Facebook? There's no difference between this and if I was playing a computer game, right?
It's Fortnite. It's the same thing.
In order to win this game at the moment, you need to increase your liquidity, right? You need to open up your bid strategies. You need to remove your audience targeting and go for broad audiences. You now need to have liquidity in your creative, like both in terms of volume and variety. And then you push it out and you kind of, you make your moves and you hit the button, and then you sit and you watch the data come back in, and then you say, okay, what's my next move? So it's just like these kind of strategy games. I think it's a really good analogy. And I often think it's quite interesting that in a way, you know, Facebook actually, people don't think of Facebook as an AI company, but it is the AI company. Facebook is totally run on all this AI and what that's doing for a marketer, the AI that Facebook has that you want to tap into is its ability to, for you to put something in to get signal back, right? Okay, these kinds of people in Nebraska and, you know, in California, and older ladies in New York and younger ladies in Mississippi or whatever are responding, and then for it to go off and then find all the other people like those people and put your ad in front of those people. And that's the kind of the magic of the AI, right? And so the more creative and content you put in, you're giving the Facebook AI more chances to say, ah, okay, great. I can see what's happening here. I can take that piece of content and show it to these people because I've got a hypothesis that they're the ones that are going to like it. And then it'll say, I was right. Those are the people. I'm going to show it to more of them. And so it's kind of our AI talking, if you like, to Facebook's AI.
Yeah.
That's when it's really exciting. You've kind of got.
That's what I was asking about, the type of mentality of the AI.
Yeah.
Like the AI being used to beat Go and to win from StarCraft. I mean, that's a complicated fucking game.
Yeah,
it's beating all the humans, right? So, so how is a human? So all the platforms are AI. All the marketing platforms are. All the exchanges are. So if you think you as a human are going to go in there and beat AI, you're crazy. And then it's a matter of how well have you trained your AI, you know, like it's garbage in, garbage out. And that's kind of what you guys are doing. And that's why you're so limited. Like when you go in, we logged in, like you're making it almost foolproof.
You build your own robot and say, hey, go and play with the Facebook robot.
Mm-hmm. So building on this team analogy, James, it's almost like you're giving like the limitless pill to your marketing team. Maybe a lot of people in Baby Bathwater like have like companies that are spending a lot of money on ads and have marketing teams. How does sort of GPT-3 like pencil and sort of this evolution of this AI space, how will that change how people should think about constructing their marketing teams and like who should be in there?
That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a great question. And you know, it's different for every brand. I think the most important question that a lot of these marketing teams have to ask themselves, and I often have this conversation, I say, look, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is I am obsessed with my brand, right? And everything must look perfect. And, you know, I don't care about performance. It's just got to look beautiful for my brand, for the on brand. And 1, which is, I don't care about my brand. Just give me results. Make money, make sales. And it's like, where are you on that scale? And it's amazing. Like some of them, and I never know. And they go, we're a 9, right? You know, at the end of the day, if I put something out there that doesn't look right for our brand, I'm going to get fired, right? Right. My boss only cares about, you know, think of Airbnb, right? If you put something out that looked horrible, right, you're not going to last long at Airbnb. And they've done very well doing it that way. And then there's other people who say, I don't even know what you mean by brand. That's like,
right. That's direct response purist. Yeah, everybody cares until money comes into play. Everybody cares about their brand that has integrity until the dollars hit, then everything changes. But it brings up a good question is, so right now it's still at the human level to like understand, for example, because it is sometimes a good decision to have, let's say you're a luxury brand, maybe it's better not to do as well on Facebook in the short term because you're going retail, because your brand has an ethos, because of exclusivity, right? And that's more of a longer term play, right? So that's a more sophisticated decision that right now brands make. And I think for the right reasons a lot of times, which is like, yeah, I could blow it up on Facebook for 3 months, but my brand's fucking dead once they realize everybody can have it. And now we like whatever. So, but if AI is winning all these games, I mean, it should be able to understand that. So when do you see a time when AI will understand those kind of more nuanced, or is there a database? Is there like a GPT for that, for nuanced thinking?
Will, what do you think?
Yeah, I think AI is actually great at nuance. Like it's nuance isn't the issue. It's whether its view on the nuance is the same as the decision maker and the company's view on the nuance, right? Like it can understand your brand to such a level of detail that it will tell you that, you know, at the base level, Nike and Adidas, not that different, right? They use similar language. They look similar in color, but they are different, right? And their difference is the sum of all the decisions that their executive team have made and the stands that they've taken and the celebrities that they've worked with. And so, you know, what that brand does next is in the mind of, you know, the leaders at that company, and the AI will have a view, but it may not be the same. So I think we talk a lot about, one of the themes we talk about is a lot about the expectation gap between what the AI is proposing and what you want. And what objectively works better, right? And
I use AI as a decision-making tool? So, because those are nuanced. So I agree with you that it should have nuance. It's just the prompts, right? So it'd be really cool, because maybe I shouldn't be having a luxury brand. Maybe I don't even have one. I just think I have one, right? Because a lot of people think they have brands that they don't have. Is there AI or prompts there to actually just get a better decision on that macro decision on whether I should allow ugly ads, for example?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good example of where something like GPT-3, because it's general purpose, you could almost stumble on that insight. So say you're a luxury brand, right? And you're generating ads with Pencil and you're following our advice and just making them as diverse as possible, right? And some of the language that you try is like super aloof and premium and very kind of, you know, up there in the sky. And some of the language is, you know, pretty direct and, on the bottom end of what you would kind of expect to talk about or sound like as a luxury brand. And you find that that works better. What do you do? Do you lean into that and then essentially make a decision to go down market with your brand or not, right? And that's what James is saying. And I think it kind of already does that, right? Because all of it is in the language. So you can make a decision. Like our friends, the pet food company, they make a decision, okay, taste is working better than nutrition. So do we start making a wider range of flavors of our dog food? Like that's what's exciting, right? That these advertising learnings are bigger than advertising. It goes all the way back to your business and your brand and, you know, all of your decisions. Ads are your front line of the interface with your customer, what they're telling you that they like. You can take that back into the business, which we think is very cool.
And right now you have the luxury of having Facebook as a validator, meaning because it's sales, like you can see how well it works. And then I imagine, let's kind of bring it to Todd, maybe asking some questions. So kind of bring this back and I'll come back to Pencil because I think it's super cool that you have something actually working, right? Because that's like a rarity. So back to customer service. So what I'm hearing is now you're trying to train GPT-3, right, for customer service and you're running into some troubles. Has any of this helped at all as far as theoretically?
Well, I think the question that I had was primarily state. So how are you managing the state of the brand? Because as it evolves, things are changing. GPT doesn't necessarily manage that state. It only manages that front end characteristic. Are you having to feed that back in? Because you only have 1,000 characters. And that's the trouble we're having is feeding in history and then having it take account of that history to then answer questions.
Yeah, that's you can't basically. It's one model, it's pre-trained and it spits things out in response to a prompt. So it doesn't internalize your context. Yes. So we take an essentially an inefficient approach, right? Which is like we over-generate And then we look at what's been generated and we see what's most similar to what we want, brand-wise, performance-wise, and we show that to the user, and the rest we throw away. That's how we do it.
So there's no feedback loop going back into GPT-3.
It's not how it works. Yeah, as you know, right? That's not how it works. So the weights that I mentioned before, like, we want to learn what kind of words you like as a brand, what words work for you as a brand, what ad, like, creative features, like how much branding, you know, product in the intro or at the end, you know, there's the call, how big should the call to action be? All of those are features. And we have a very long list of things like that that we create because we want to be able to explain to our users what has been learned. And then we have weightings based on what is working and not working. And that is the internalization of your specific context, but we've had to create that. GPT-3 doesn't take feedback as it were, it just takes a prompt, as you know. So any feedback has to be built by us on top of it.
So what we were trying to do was substitute GPT-3 as a bot to then not have an individual, as many individuals in seats. And as you know, if you have a conversation with GPT-3 at a prompt level, it will have a conversation, go way off topic very quickly, and it can give you very oddball answers. And so the best we could do was it would throw out three possibilities and the customer service individual could just click on it and say, yes, that's the one I want. But as far as it replacing an individual to have a conversation, we just couldn't get it to do that at this point.
Yeah, it's a difficult challenge, right? Because it's a conversation, right? Which is an additional dynamic to just an ad, which is like, you know, a consumption behavior. It's such an interesting use case though. Like, I mean, I guess the goal is the goal just to replace the human entirely, or is the goal to have a better customer service outcome? Like if it was, you know, like Google in Gmail, you know, it's like suggesting which phrase you should reply when someone sends you asks you a question. You know, presumably if there's three things you can say and you're optimizing for satisfaction or whatever, one of those three things will work better than the other. So which one should you say? That is interesting. Like if you're optimizing for the satisfaction at the end of a call and you have data, then you can do something cool there, but you're not replacing the human entirely. Right. But it's still very cool. So
the biggest thing was where's my package? Cause we're in fulfillment. If we could just go back and say, hey, where's my package? And GPT-3 said, oh, you know what? I need to go and look at the warehouse management system, because that's where all the tracking information is. But it's that interaction just still doesn't exist, right? So we have to write a fair amount of outside code, and then GPT-3 has to know, hey, I need to go over to that system to go look for it. And that level of intelligence just isn't there. State management doesn't exist.
What about sentiment analysis?
Yeah.
Will, do you know anything about that in terms of like what GPT-3 can do in terms of sentiment analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I used to work as like a social listening. Did a lot of social listening when I was starting my career, and it's quite easy to get a rough read on positive, negative, but you know, you know, at the time it was keyword based and that kind of thing. So GPT-3 can definitely do sentiment analysis. You know, you provide a few examples of what you consider positive and negative, and then you give it a line and it guesses. And it's pretty good, because even though you've only given it three examples, it's read the entire internet, and a lot of the subtleties are baked into its existing knowledge, its pre-existing knowledge. So yeah, that's a good example of a task that a general purpose language model can be used to solve. Maybe not as well as a model specifically being trained for that task, but you know, you set it up in seconds.
I mean, that could definitely be interesting for like the customer service side of things, to be able to say, okay, this, you know, this customer's angry, they're upset, and you know, here's a range of things to say based on like what emotion they're experiencing, and you know, having you know, particular outcomes that you want out of those different responses.
So what I'm finding out, GPT-3 is good at spitting out possibilities. It's still up to a human to say, yeah, that's the right context. it'll analyze like, oh, which way you want to go with a conversation, and it throws out some really great options, but it still, from a decision standpoint, still needs a operator to choose, to say, yeah, okay, I want to take that conversation in that direction.
But still shortens the feedback loop, right? Because then you're saving time on like them having to come up with responses or know exactly what to say.
Yeah.
This is interesting. Yeah, so now I'm understanding more. So that's why, like, so Pencil, let's go through some other. So you're doing it because you've just trained it extremely well. You understand the core of it, you understand what it does, and you understand its flaws, and you understand its benefits. And so you have a narrow focus with just the ads, and now you got a feedback loop, and then you're getting results because you're giving it the right prompts, and then getting rid of the information that doesn't matter.
I think the prompts matter. The prompts are important, but I would say that what we've done is we've built a system around GPT-3 that allows it to be applied in a highly impactful way that is low effort from the user. Right. And you got to have the right objectives of what you're trying to achieve, knowing what the technology can do, and you've got to build kind of like an interface and a way that GPT-3 interacts with your other systems in such a way that the minimum input from a user, you can get outputs which are the right ones, or a set of the right ones. Mm-hmm. You also want to try and solve the simplest problems at a time. So, or simplest problems first. So, you know, having detailed knowledge of your, you know, like inventory management system is not something that GPT-3 has. But you know, telling it that a pair of shoes are leather and cost $6, you know, it can then go off and talk about that. Like, you've got to give it like a kernel of information, and then it improvises. And that's great. That's great for our use case. Obviously it's trickier with something like customer service. But yeah, I think it's just about breaking the problem you're trying to solve down into such a small problem that then you can apply GPT-3 and it nails the solution to that small problem. And then you move on to the next problem. And it's like, that's how we think about it. Because one of the things we learned early on in our journey as a company is that nobody wants a model that works 30% of the time.
Yeah.
It's like we were at first, because when we first started, we would generate 1,000 lines of copy and two of them were good. Mm-hmm. 2 in 1,000, right? Like that. And we were like, yes, we found two lines that are good. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants that. And we got, eventually we got to 60% with GPT-2, and still nobody wanted that, right? And now we're at 94% and people are, yeah, okay, we want that, we'll take that. You need to build an implementation that works incredibly well. And the only way that you do that is by focusing on the smallest possible problem at a time and then moving on to the next problem.
Cool. So it's working on things where it's creativity, not too much interaction right now, sounds like. That's going to be hard. So like right now, we got a lot of questions from the group about, like, let me run through them. So you guys are doing it for media buying, I think the only one. But then there's like Headline, Hypotenuse, Copysmith, Copy AI, Flowrite. So it looks like a lot of companies are out there for copywriting, right? Not ad writing and not this thing. But so what do you look for in those? Like, so now they're all out there saying they can write your copy just like the best copywriter in the world. It does seem like it's because it's not a conversation, that it might just spit out some good shit. But then what I'm also going is, how are they learning like you're learning?
I mean, I think GPT-3 is a kind of enabling technology. So it's given rise to lots of companies that can now offer this service. And we saw this, you know, 2 years ago. We saw that these models were going to get to the point where lots of these copy-specific companies would exist. And that's when we said, okay, well, we're going to go one step further, or in some cases, 10 step further, and do the entire video, the narrative, everything. And we're going to learn what works from Facebook and tell you, and. So we just started working on a harder version, a more complete version of this problem earlier, which is how we're different to like some of the copywriting focused companies. We produce the entire ad and tell you whether it's going to work or not, you know, using your own data. Yeah. So that's the difference. Your question, I think, was how do you assess which one to use? Maybe, is that the question?
Yes, it's an assessment, because they're coming out like wildfire, and I'm looking at them going, especially after listening to you, going, okay, great. I can see how I can generate copy based on some rules, like, but then great, it has a body of knowledge now. Some good, but it's not getting this continuous feedback you're getting, like on Facebook, to know what's working. So how are these platforms learning? So it's going to write me copy, but then how is it getting better?
I don't think they are. They're just giving you ideas. They're just giving you new ideas to try, which has value. Does have value. But they're not I don't think that they are learning tools, right? They're just ideation tools, which is good. But I think in the same way, like Todd was saying, when you're building a product, you got to consider the overall system and how the technology fits in. If you're a business and you've got an overall system of which is your business and your marketing team and your agency or whatever, how the technology fits in is often also something you have to design. And if you plug the wrong technology into the system that is your business, it won't add value. But if you plug the same technology into a smaller part of your business, maybe your specific team or a specific part of their day, then maybe it does. So you got to kind of find where to apply the technology to add value.
Yeah, because I can see it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, just to add to that, some of them are learning. I don't think like you said, you started solving this problem like 2 years ahead of time, but I think some of them are slowly catching up. Like Usebroka looks at Google ads and will look at KPIs within the Google account to write headlines based on winning iterations.
Okay, good.
And Copysmith is rolling that out in beta now. So just want to acknowledge you guys for being like way ahead of that problem. But I think that we'll see more and more people like applying that to their.
Yeah, there's not an objective success flywheel. It's going to be really hard for it to get better, but I do see the use, like right now, I guess if people are looking at this, I'm saying like, okay, use it for, because awesome, best practices are great. And that AI will give you not only best practices, but an example of the use of best practice. So that's a great thing, not bad, but don't expect that it's really intelligent. I mean, really learning. And then like you say, use Broca and now Pencil. I'd be looking for AI that has a feedback loop of some sort.
Yeah, that's the one of the key value propositions, right? Is to be able to apply it to like what Pencil's doing, to be able to do one, like have a positive feedback loop around like what's working, and then the predictive analytics, like learning from your ad account, because it, like if you think about the feedback loop now, you have to have like a media buyer that goes and looks at the account, right? They're like, okay, well, these ad lines kind of worked, these images kind of worked, like these ad sets kind of worked. And then they have to go back to their creative team, talk to them. Whereas a platform like Pencil can take all of that and just dramatically shortens that feedback loop. Yeah. You can make more decisions faster, which is going to give you like a extreme competitive advantage when it comes to like the game of media buying.
Yeah, I think just building on that, it is humans that tend to slow things down and get in the way. The classic Facebook team, performance marketing team is like a triangle, right? You have a creative person, a designer, and then you have the media person who knows how to use Facebook Ads Manager and actually run the ads and set up the tests. And then you might have the data or the analyst person who can look at the data and interpret it and decide what needs doing. And that's great. It's great to have three people, but if one of them is on holiday or something and it slows things down or you lose someone, if you can collapse that down and make one person empowered to be able to do everything, then it can just become so fast, because they wake up in the morning, they look at the data, like they're playing the game, right? They look at the data, they see what needs doing, they make their next move all on their own. And then reset the pieces. And they're just kind of doing that on a daily basis.
Sure. Yeah. So unless you have like what you're doing or the people going to work with Google or other things, you need a loop of accurate feedback and volume, or else all you have is a suggestion engine for the most part with AI, what I'm hearing. Is that correct? So Todd, you're having a problem because it's a suggestion engine, but it's not really thinking, because you're not giving it enough to think on. And there's no, unless you think of a way in customer service where there's a win and a loss, there's no way it's going to get there. Is that kind of the correct thinking? And so when we think about applying it to certain divisions of our companies, if you can't have a way, like that's why it's winning video games. It's obvious whether they're winning or losing. They're dying, they're not, right? So it can learn StarCraft, right? But there's feedback loops.
Yeah, so. it is the speed of the loop.
Speed of the loop.
It's like Darwinian, you know, evolution, right?
Yes.
The loop, that's the evolution happens really fast.
Yep, faster with fruit flies than humans, for sure.
Exactly.
Yes.
Someone should create an agency called Fruit Fly.
Yeah, Fruit Fly. That'd be amazing. This is cool because your stuff works. And then, yeah, but then we want an overall discussion. There's certain things right now, at least with right now, the state of the thing where you, so people have this imagination. I think I did too, of AI. We watched, you know, HAL 2001. They're going to have these personalities. I know there's AI working with psychotherapy, which is interesting. I wonder how they're doing it. But I know that it's been very effective and validated. But I don't think that's GPT, right? Or is it?
I don't know. There's a wonderful guy at a brand called Youper.ai, Youper.ai, which is very strong in this area. It's really applied both AI and psychotherapy. So those would be good guys to talk to. I can definitely introduce you to the founder of that.
That's fascinating because it's kind of putting it all together. So you guys have figured it out, but you guys have a nice closed loop to work with.
Yeah.
And you're accelerating, and other people are going to do it with Google, or maybe you will too. That'd be nice. And then the people right now, unless you have a closed loop to work with, all you get is a suggestion engine and probably not waste too much time on it unless that's what you want.
It's kind of
the other way to do it is to train, like the old fashioned way, is to train the model yourself with examples, lots of examples. So in that space you mentioned, there's a company called Limbic.ai that we share an investor with. And if I understand it correctly, they basically are, they have a data set of like fitness tracker, you know, like heart rate and different measurements from the body. And they have a therapy data set of like mood and emotional profile and all that. And then they've trained a model to kind of predict that from the underlying like biometric data. And then, you know, your therapist has access to it and can monitor, you know, your mood basically. You know, and your kind of mental state, I guess, is where they're going with it.
Yeah.
And help you think through. Like if you're having a really stressful moment, you get a ping saying, hey.
This is super cool. So is this on the GPT framework or is it a different framework?
No, these guys are, I think I started in academia. So they're building their own infrastructure.
Right, so right, Tom, like for customer service, like maybe it's better to go see what the therapy is. You know, like I'm just thinking out loud, like I always do, is, that's that shit, is the, maybe this. Right. Because there's other platforms. Right. So if you're doing customer service or things like that, maybe look into these other AIs for psychology, because I know, and I didn't know the examples you have, but I know it's getting good data.
Yeah. I know GPT-3 is actually being used in the psychological realm. I know there's folks that raised some money and came out with an actual phone app. And I took a look at it and it's interesting. It's very limited in what it can do. And, but yeah, looking at other models, we're definitely going to have to look at, you know,
how to
work outside of it. And I know they've got another beta piece that's supposed to help train GPT-3 more, that just opened up a couple weeks ago. And, we've been trying to figure out how to utilize that particular piece from a state management and teaching.
Right. It's going to be a wild world. So Mike, besides like this, are you seeing, have you used any of these AI tools to any effect?
We're using Copysmith for clients. And I'd like to get my hands on Pencil at some point here soon.
Yeah.
Just because I think that Copysmith definitely has its limitations. You definitely still have to have like a person review the copy. It can definitely generate a lot of ideas and it can shorten that feedback loop, but it's not doing the full, kind of like looking at the ad account, learning from the data, which I think is going to be the most useful use case there. But definitely saves a ton of time and like labor costs in terms of like having to produce copy, headlines, like product descriptions, et cetera. I have a friend that I shared, Copysmith, and they're using it for their Amazon business to write all of their product descriptions. So there's definitely a lot of like value being created by that. And then tools like Pencil are like the obvious like next progression, because they have the full feedback loop already integrated into what they've built.
You could do like the Pencil to a copy AI written landing page. That'd be a good test. So just fully.
Yeah, that's something that I definitely see like in the future, is to being able to do like one click like websites. Like Headlime and CopySmith already have some like landing pages built in, but it already has access to all this data. So if you're able to like put a customer avatar, like what your product is, et cetera, and then feed it, you know, some of like the best performing, highest conversion rate sites, like we're not too far off where you're going to be able to like click a button and say, build me, you know, a landing page for this green supplement for, you know, women over 40 that, you know, have these particular problems.
Yeah.
And that like, think about how much that costs like right now and how long that takes to get a landing page spun up.
So are any of these copied AI things getting the CRO data, like heat map data or getting time on site data, exit? I mean, all the data that I would use to do CRO, or conversion rate, or is any AI landing page software is getting that data?
BWO is applying GPT-3 to their product already. Yeah. So we should be able to see like multivariate testing with GPT-3 applied, which is going to be badass.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah, because then you're getting, you know, 30 plus variations, and then it's learning from the top variation out of those 30s versus just the split test. So when you apply it to like GPT-3 to like CRO plus, you get the feedback loop for like the ad side, you're getting like two massive feedback loops for like any sort of performance, like advertising. So that's something I'm really excited about. And it's going to make it way easier for people to kind of like, one, that people are aware of the problem, they're going to be able to use this first, and they're going to have a huge advantage because everybody's kind of slow to change or to apply like new technology to their business outside of like entrepreneurs. But
this is very cool. That is the future, once you can do it all the way through. So there's ad buying at Pencil, but then if I could start to get the landing pages tested, because as you know, certain ads are going to work better with certain landers too. There's a scent match. So how do you run that all the way through and then serve the right ad, serve the right landing page? Crazy. And have it write it for you. I didn't know BWO did that. I used to use them all the time. That's really cool. So one question, I don't think anybody can answer, but obviously people are going to start using GPT-3 for SEO content writing, right? That's just going to happen. Probably is. I think Google's going to start penalizing that. Or could they find it out so easily? Could they sniff it out?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think that's going to be a huge problem, is, you know, people are going to be able to like spin up content. Like that's one of the challenges that we already see, is that there's like not a universal source of truth for what's true on the internet. Right. And Will or James, maybe you guys have a different perspective on this. Like, is there a way to tell like what's been generated by like an algorithm versus a human being? Because as far as I know, I don't see a way to do that.
Yeah, there are. There are. I mean, it depends on the complexity of the model, and whether it's producing text in a way that has patterns that are detectable as made by it. But I think the one interesting question as well is, you know, whether AI generated SEO copy is necessarily a bad thing, right? Like Google will penalize it if it is unhelpful for offering Google's users truth, or, you know, if not truth, the value that they're looking for. So if, you know, a small business uses AI to better explain what they are and what value they offer, and that results in more accurate, more effective search results, people finding what they want, then that's in Google's interest. If it results in spam and, you know, and lowers the quality of the results, then it's not in Google's interest. But I mean, we certainly take the view that just because content is made by AI doesn't mean that it's worse or it's fake, or it could be better, right? Not just in terms of utility, but in terms of like, value to both the consumer and the business. So I think it depends whether it's people use it as essentially an offensive tactic to game the system, or whether they use it as a better way of explaining their business and, you know, plays by the rules that are in the interest of Google's users too.
Here's
a question for you. If Google did start penalizing GPT-3 generated SEO and at the same time it had its own alternative, would that be anti-competitive?
Right.
Yes.
Could be, certainly. I bet a lot of SEO content is, because it's just too easy. It's in a way it's not.
Yeah, I think the dominant way is, you know, you still, it's AI plus humans equals superhumans.
Yeah.
And I just think, yes, everyone will use this, but you'll use it to write the base. So you're not staring at a blank piece of paper. And then you go in, you look at it and you work on it, and it's much, much faster. Mm-hmm. So it kind of overcomes, it gets you started, it creates the framework, the structure, and then you go in and you finish it off. So in a way, for a lot of us, you get leveraged by having, you know, smart people working for you, right? Mm-hmm. They generate things for you, they send it to you, you edit it, you finish it off, you put the final touches, and then you ship it. And that's kind of what smart people have always done. They've leveraged other people's talent.
Yep.
And I think now you can, that's what you use GPT-3 for. That's what you use these tools for. It's like, okay, make me the first draft. I will go in and make it much better.
Very cool. Well, guys, I think it's a little over an hour now. This has been fun.
It has been
a wonderful conversation. And yeah, we'll have links about how to contact Pencil or Mike or anybody else. And this is super cool. Really appreciate it. We could go down the philosophical bubble, but that rabbit hole is like, that's like a Philip Dick book or something, you know, we could do that, but I don't see it benefiting anybody.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. It was really interesting.
Fun. All right. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate y'all.
Michael, thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.